cliffcentral.com.
The Burning Platform is here, though. That's one consistency. And every Thursday we get together to talk about the most important things in the world. And my God, are there important things to talk about in the world this week? Sometimes we scramble a little to find political stories, stories that affect society. Sometimes stories about the economy creep in. But all of those are extra relevant in a time like this. And there isn't a person on earth who isn't affected by it. From the very rich to the very poor, to the very young, to the very old, to the people who have much, to the people who have little, to people who are connected and people who are disconnected. Everyone is affected. And I think that that's probably the theme for the next few days. For the Burning Platform this morning, which is brought to you every week by Nando's, and I saw a brilliant video of a little girl in England, and her mother says to her, "We're not going to be able to go to Nando's." And she goes, "Oh." She breaks down like a you know, spoiled little brat. She doesn't want to eat anything but Nando's. So I think there are probably people all over the world who are going to be affected by that as a small thing. But some of the big things are going to have much longer term effects on all of us. Joined on the line this morning from Knysna by Ivo Fechter. Ivo, first of all, congratulations. I believe you've left the Daily Maverick, and you are now a free man. You're working for the Daily Friend. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. I've decided to throw my hat in with the Institute for Race Relations. I've had a long relationship with them, and you know, my views, which are sort of liberal, libertarian, very much coincide with theirs on many subjects. So I'm really excited to sort of grow the space for liberal thought in South Africa.
Was it acrimonious with the Daily Maverick, or are you guys still friends?
No, it wasn't acrimonious. You know, it was. I just started feeling in the last few years that it really wasn't the place for me anymore. You know, there was a lot of, you know, a lot of it's just gone a bit left wing for me. You know, I'm not going to say much more about that, but. I was starting to get the feeling that some of my views just weren't welcome there. You know, so it was time to move on. I've been there for a very long time. You know, I've been there. I was their very first columnist.
Right.
In 2009 when they started, and even before that with the print magazine in 2006, I was there. So, you know, it's been a large part of my career, and I'm very grateful to Daily Maverick because they've always given me a great platform and great freedom to.
There was never any outright condemnation of something you'd written, or there was never any editorial influence exerted upon you during the time that you were there.
Well, there were one or two articles that they didn't want to publish that I wrote, you know, and you know, last week, in fact, there was one on price controls.
Uh-huh.
You know, I wrote in defense of price gouging, saying that this is an essential signal to the market to produce more of what is in high demand, right? Because people are starting to get worried about, you know, toilet paper, hand sanitizer, etc.
Right.
So it was an economic argument, and you know, they felt that it maybe in this time of crisis it wasn't the right time to publish that. Well, I disagreed with that. I eventually published that on Politics Web.
Okay. Well, you know what we're going to do for the purposes of this morning. You're totally free, Ivo. You can say whatever the hell you want.
I'll try not to say something that'll get me lynched.
Unlikely. Yeah. All right. And also,
unlikely.
Our returning champion. Thank you for coming in right there, Canton, because it is my turn to introduce you, Canton Pillay. You're in. In lockdown in Plettenberg Bay.
In fact, I'm not sure whether my audio is coming.
Yeah, it's all right. As long as you...
The level's a bit...
There we go. That's
just let me know when it's okay.
That's perfect.
All right, perfect. Yeah. Yes, I'm in lockdown in Plett. In fact, I happened to be in Ivo's neck of the woods yesterday because I had to make a run to the Dis-Chem.
Uh-huh.
Of course, in the godforsaken part of the country, the only place where there's a Dis-Chem to be found is in Knysna. So I had to drive... 70 Ks, 35 Ks there, and 35 Ks back to Sarah's asthma medication. But
you didn't have to brave a 35-kilometer long queue once you were there, did you?
No, I did not. No, I did not. And
that's good news.
In fact, things out here have been remarkably civilized. There's been an abundance of stuff on the shelves, and you know, the orderly queues to get into places. But I found it quite refreshing compared to the reports I've been getting back from Gauteng in terms of the chaos that has been present out there.
Well, I mentioned this morning, I went to the shops yesterday, and I also found it to be quite orderly and civilized. No one was beating anyone up. But I do see a bit of a wild look in some people's eyes, you know, that if it were a zombie apocalypse, they would definitely try to eat you. Do you get that impression?
I don't think so. This is the Western Cape. You know, there's a... I think the propensity of people who go shopping in the Knysna Mall, which is where I was yesterday, to be packing heat is extremely rare, I would think. I suspect that Ivo would probably be an exception to
you,
that.
You don't know everyone in Knysna, Ken.
No, very much so. I concede that immediately, Ivo, and and I certainly am aware of in Knysna who would have no qualms whatsoever about eating the masses. But
I want to ask you both something related to that, because you bring in packing heat to the discussion, but there are people who have vast ammunition caches at home. There are a lot of people in South Africa who have more than one gun. There are also the deployments of the military in various parts of the country to try and keep order. Are we ratcheting up the possibility for violence here, or is this just people looking out for themselves?
Look, I want to climb in there first. And I think that one of the things that I've noticed about the way we've handled this entire thing so far is something we've talked about in the show before, Gareth, the fact that as South Africans, we actually have this ability to work very well with each other.
Yeah.
I think that if you look across the board, we've seen people who've been behaving overall in an extremely orderly fashion. They've been, you know, relatively courteous towards each other. The niceties around safe spaces and all of that kind of stuff. You know, never thought that I'd be a fan of safe spaces, but there you go.
Yeah, who knew? What do you think of this, Ivo? I mean, have you got a gun? Did you go out and buy extra ammo?
I don't have a gun, although I have no objection to people who legally own guns. I've always got the impression that most people who legally own guns are not very likely to use them. I don't see legal gun owners suddenly, you know, packing heat, as Canton says, on the streets. Where I do see a risk for violence, and this is something that that does trouble me a bit, is that when you go, especially into poorer areas of the country, and you now have a lot of people that are unemployed, that have lost their income.
Yeah.
You know, even if there's some support for salaried workers and you know, people who work for big company, formal companies, there's no support for people who worked in the informal sector, for example. You know, so you have a lot of people who've just lost their income. Which is critical to them. I mean, they live from check to check, sometimes on a weekly basis. Now they're being told to lock down in their houses. I see significant risk of social unrest in various parts of the country. You know, people are going to look at this and say, well, look, you know, the government, they might believe that, I don't know, the virus only affects white people or rich people or tourists.
Yeah.
And that all of this imposition by the state is unjustified, and react to that. So the potential for social unrest, I think, is absolutely there, and that could get violent and that could get bloody, especially when you have soldiers on the streets that, frankly, are trained to kill the enemy. They are not trained to deal with crowd control and riots, you know, so... We may have a potential for conflict there, yes.
Well, it's interesting. The last time we spoke about this was when the army was called into the Cape Flats to help manage gang violence there. And a similar point of view was then expressed by Canton, among others. But I think in this situation, it's better to be safe than sorry and have these guys on standby, because we do have an increasingly desperate population, and during these 21 days they may become more desperate. People who are in close quarters, people who don't have a lot of money, who might run out of resources at some point, and if this disease really starts to hit hard, will be losing loved ones and become increasingly agitated. there's a possibility that this thing could get very out of control. But I do have to say at this stage, Canthan's point that we all are getting along and working together and mostly trying to do the right thing seems to me to be about right.
Yes, I would agree. But you're right. Look, if they're going to shut down the economy, yes, that is a crisis intervention.
Sure.
And it's a draconian intervention.
Hmm.
And in order to get away with draconian interventions, yes, governments are going to have to put armies on the street. That's a consequence of that. I think we need to discuss it some, but whether it's justified to shut down the economy in the first place, to take these extreme measures.
There's an interesting...
I think we probably need to climb in on that particular point. I think, I tend to take the view as well that a lot of the measures that have been taken up late, which have directly impacted on shutting down the economy, need not have been done. So a very specific example, the shutting down of services as a specific example, because you do have a very constrained environment out there, but it does allow for people right now who, let's say, live within... I know, for example, there are people who live in the Mamboneng precinct who are entirely dependent on ride-hailing services in order to get access to things like supermarkets or to get access to things like medical assistance,
mm-hmm.
be able to stock their apartments. But it's another thing if they need to get across town to go to a doctor. How do they actually end up getting access to it in that type of scenario? I think that is one of those examples where just a blanket shutdown of all transport facilities was not in everyone's interest. I certainly can see an advantage in shutting down mass transit, mm. as in minibus taxi, simply because you do have a multiplicity of people that have been crammed into a single space for transmission. So I suppose what we've ended up with here, needed to use a bazooka just simply in order to avoid the impression that they are favoring the rich.
Well, I'd like to just...
would not have been possible to shut down the bus stand.
I'd like to zoom out for a second and ask both of you whether you think, and Mbulelo, jump in here if you've got an opinion here too, because I'm increasingly hearing economists on one side of the argument and health workers on the other, and they seem to me to not be able to find any overlapping magisterium here. In other words, that the health workers are saying we must stay away from each other until we know for sure that this disease has been stamped out, that the window period for people being infected and passing it on is now closed, and we are safe to proceed 21 days, and let's not have any contact with each other. And if that means shutting down the economy, so be it. And on the other end, we've got the economists who are saying, there is a price that you will pay long term for this, which may end up killing more people, pushing more people into poverty, disrupting business, ruining an economy completely, which was already struggling. It was, we were limping along as it was. And the economists are saying there is a point where a certain number of deaths is inevitable, but you can still save the economy. And you got health workers on the opposite end of the scale saying that no number of deaths is worth making the sacrifice of passing this disease on to the majority of the population. Is there a middle ground here?
It's a classic problem in philosophy, right? If you if you've ever studied philosophy or public policy for that matter, you'll come across the trolley problem, right? Which is you've got a train going down a track, and in front of you, you've got one person tied to the track, and three people tied to the track, and on the other track, you've got one person tied to the track. You need to decide whether you keep the train in one direction, in which case you cannot directly be attributed or accused of the deaths of three people, or to turn the switch and to turn the train and kill one person, in which case you can be directly guilty for that one person, but you have saved two lives, relatively speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a moral conundrum. Right? Is it worth the cost, saving what might be, a few thousand people over the age of 70? at the cost of shutting down an economy that, especially in a poor country, is really critical for people's survival. You know, I've been worrying about a lot of the consequences here. You know, they shut down the beaches here, which are largely deserted, but do play a host to a lot of indigent fishermen. You know, they'll catch a few fish every day and go and hawk them around, you know, to try and make, this is their only income. What do they do when they get home and they can't feed their children? You know, what does that do if they have family members that suffer from TB or HIV or something that are already compromised from a health perspective or have diabetes and that now can't eat properly? How many of those are going to die? You know, we spoke about unrest. That can cause a number of deaths. So among epidemiologists, there is disagreement about how severe the effects of this might be. Right? They have a fairly good idea how rapidly it spreads, but they don't really have a good handle on mortality rates. And that's for a number of statistical reasons. You know, they largely measure people that already present themselves with medical symptoms at hospitals. So the mortality rate could be anywhere between, I think the lowest I've seen is 0.12%. I've seen it somewhere around 5 or 6%. So it's a massive range of uncertainty. So we might have, I don't know, several thousand people on the one hand that could die as a result of this. On the other hand, we could have several thousand or perhaps more people that die as a consequence of shutting down the economy.
Right.
And how many more? I mean, possibly millions more that suffer greatly. You know, they might lose their houses. They might, they've lost their jobs. There's great human suffering in the emergency response, and you need to weigh up the two.
Right.
Now, an epidemiologist will only look at the disease and say, well, you know, yeah, we need to do this to avoid these deaths. An economist will look at the other side of the coin and say, well, hold on. What happens if we shut down the economy? Is this not worse? And right. I think that's a very, very valid question to ask. And I'm not sure that I've got the answer.
Well, you want to have a stab,
but I absolutely think we need to consider.
Yeah, well, one of the things I want to toss into this is that I think that the reaction from our government might have been significantly different had they been a couple of decades younger collectively, very much in the higher risk group.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. And, so if I draw a direct correlation between the immediate response of, let's say, Boris Johnson, whose view was very much a question of, actually, we're going to hold back and try and build herd immunity up front. Now, there was a piece that popped up in the Financial Times, I think it was a day or so ago, which actually speculates that you've already hit something like 50% infections among the UK populace. Simply because of the fact that testing has not actually been taking place. And because of the high rate of transmission of this particular virus, that it's very possible, because the majority of people exhibit really absolutely mild symptoms in reaction to this. So there's a view that, in fact, the UK might already have made significant strides in terms of attaining herd immunity at this level. So it is exactly the trolley problem that Ivo has been talking about. I do think that the shutting down of the economy as a whole, yes, it's going to be disastrous, particularly for the people right now who, for example, they work, they live in basically in squatter camps. They work in the cities, but when they work in the cities, they have access to drinking water.
Yeah,
they have. Right now, if they go back to the places where they spend their nights, they don't have access to running water other than communal facilities, which again, in fact, exacerbates the conditions under which infections could actually take place. So I don't have the answer, but I do think that we have taken a particular course And I guess the question, the direct correlation that we need to take a look at, places that just lack the capacity to enforce the type of thing that we've done. So Zimbabwe is a direct correlation. And I guess what will be interesting is to see how this plays out. Zimbabwe comes through this versus the way in which we come through this.
Well, Ivo, you've written extensively about a number of issues, including environmental impacts and diseases over the past. I mean, you've got some views on coronavirus and on this herd immunity idea in the UK, that if 50% of the population, as Canton points out, already have the disease, they probably have a good argument against this catastrophic shutdown of economies. That's unclear because Boris seems to have caved to pressure to be more draconian. But what is your view about the countries who've handled it well and the countries who've handled it badly?
Well, South Korea is an interesting case because they didn't shut down the economy. They did impose pretty strict sort of social distancing protocols.
And of course, they had more testing.
They had a lot more testing, and that's, I think, one of the very important things. With widespread testing, the first effect that you get is that the apparent mortality rate decreases. In South Korea, it was 0.6%, which is still significantly higher than the flu at 0.1%. But it's a lot less than what they were seeing in China, for example, at 4.something percent, and in some other countries where the testing was much more limited. On the Diamond Princess cruise ship was actually interesting because there you had 700 people, average age very high, lots of retired rich people, and very much confined. So there was an ideal conditions for spreading the virus. Seven of those died. So that gives you a mortality rate of 0.1% in a particularly vulnerable population. And that's one of the few places where the entire population was sampled. You know, an entire closed population. But what they did is they did very targeted interventions. Look, they did have a fairly compliant and responsible citizenry, which maybe we don't have, you know. But, you know, they respected a lot of the rules that were put in place, and they cleaned their hands and they kept social distances. They worked from home when they could, et cetera. And that's been very effective in South Korea. So that's very much in contrast to the Chinese model, which was a crackdown like we've seen here. And we're really following the Chinese model. And there have been some other countries that have approached this differently as well. The Netherlands has also taken the herd immunity approach. They're trying to reduce the speed of the spread of the infection, but they really don't want to stop the spread because they believe that the pandemic needs to sort of needs to burn itself out, like we've seen with any other pandemic. You know, we've seen coronaviruses before, perhaps not as virulent as this one, but we've seen them before. They cause respiratory infections in vulnerable people. In fact, millions of people die of respiratory infections every year as a result of coronaviruses or the common flu. And you know, we don't shut down economies because of that. Right? We take public health measures and so on, and that leaves us in a far better position, to deal with future epidemics. I mean, what I worry about is if we destroy our economy and we've got negative 10 or 20% growth in this quarter, certainly, perhaps in the next quarter, and we end up the year on -5% or -10% GDP growth, what does that mean for funding for public hospitals? What does that mean for the affordability of private healthcare? How will our hospitals be in a position 2 or 3 years from now with an economy that is in a far worse state, in order to deal with whatever new coronavirus emerges? And it will, you know, they emerge every few years, a new coronavirus pops up. What happens with the next one? These are important questions to ask.
I'm also curious about what your thoughts are on projections that the US economy could face a 20% unemployment rate when all of this is over. Do you think that that's alarmist, or do you think that that's entirely a possibility? And what do you think the consequences of that will be in America's market, which obviously will then have a knock-on effect on everybody else?
Well, I think that's a threat everywhere. You know, our unemployment rate was creeping up to 30% in this country. I expect a massive spike in unemployment in this country, particularly from the informal sector, where there's absolutely no protections and no, you know, no sort of backup and safeguards and insurance or government support. I think unemployment is going to rise worldwide. You know, with that comes all sorts of political issues. You know, you've seen the rise of populism in many countries with high unemployment, especially if they also have high immigration, which, you know, a lot of people attribute unemployment to immigration. So you get a lot of political fallout. Economically, I think the world is headed for a lengthy recession and perhaps a depression. You know, this would be the first depression in 90 years. You know, so, as a result of the response to the coronavirus, not the virus itself.
Right. Well, I mean, do you think, again, with the long view on history here, because we see China is slowly starting to come back online, and I don't mean online digitally. I mean, they've opened up the Great Wall again to tourists. Their economy is slowly starting to pick up. Wuhan is no longer under lockdown. And it's only been, what, 2 months of this in China? Industry starting to kick back into gear. Is there a possibility that this whole nightmare could be over and we can just move on? Or is that not even a possibility?
Well, I think a significant difference that's going to kick in after this has all blown over is the world's reliance on China as the global manufacturing hub is going to fall away. And I think that that's actually a positive outcome that emerges from this entire thing. You know, in as much as the economies of scale have always favored the model of getting the Chinese to be the factory shop for, what we have seen right now is our ability across the globe to be able to very quickly turn around things to actually suit local interests. So, for example, so much of our pharmaceutical industries are dependent upon materials that ultimately are sourced from China. Mm-hmm. So our ability, for example, to suddenly mass produce things like test kits is severely constrained because of the fact that we've outsourced that stuff across the pond. Even things at the level of manufacturing of toilet paper to a large extent, China. So I think that there's an argument to be made for ensuring that there is strategic capacity that is actually built at a local level, so that in the event of being in a scenario where right now this happens to be because of a pandemic, but what if the scenario was because of a military conflict, say, in that part of the world, to then shut off, which then again leaves us in this neck of the woods without any vested interest in whatever conflict is playing itself out there. But effectively, our economy then shuts down as a direct result of that. And I think that there's going to be a lot of soul searching that gets done at a global level. You're going to see governments that are now recognizing that they need to identify strategic manufacturing capacity that has to be sustained at a local level. And what that means in the long term, I think that China now is never going to regain the hegemony that it had in terms of being the factory of the world. Ivo, what do you think?
I'm not convinced that that's a good thing. I'm a great fan of globalization and of the economic efficiencies that come with global trade, and you know, making things where they are most efficiently made. I think that benefits both that country and the consuming countries. You know, consuming countries, we get far less expensive goods as a consequence of that. So, you know, I think it's perhaps arguable that building a strategic capacity for certain pharmaceuticals and so on is a good idea, so that we can produce them if in an emergency we would need to. But I'm not convinced that we should rely on local capacity and sort of turn inwards, you know, to sort of a self-sufficiency or a greater degree of self-sufficiency. I don't think it's worked anywhere in the world. It's made things expensive. It's caused shortages. It's reduced quality. It's reduced choice. You know, and all of those things are what ultimately makes the world richer. You know,
you're absolutely right. And I'm talking about this fine line between protecting strategic interest and protectionism. Protectionism never works, and it leads to exactly the type of scenario that you've been speaking of. And again, what I'm saying is I don't have the answers right now in terms of how this resolves itself. But what I'm very clear about is that we are never going to go back to a scenario where China is going to be the custodian of those things at the same level that it has been up until the end of 2019.
Yeah, I'm curious also about how this does affect entrepreneurs and small businesses, because we know big businesses can probably pick things up. They might have to take out some loans, they might have to cut some costs and lose some of the fat along the way. But largely, big businesses will be able to pick up things where they left them off and carry on. Small businesses might not have the cash flow to be able to survive for more than a month or two. And that means for the vast majority of people who are employed in South Africa, and remember, are not employed by big business, that those people won't find a job waiting for them when this is over.
Yeah, I think that is a huge threat. You know, you're right. They don't have, most small businesses don't have the cash flow to survive even a month without revenue.
Yeah,
this could last long. I mean, you know, we've been shut down for 21 days now, but in the government plans, there's provision to extending that to 3 months if necessary. And there's absolutely no guarantee that 21 days will actually be sufficient and that the disease won't simply start spreading and spiking once the lockdown is lifted in 21 days. So this could last for a long time. I seriously worry about small business. I mean, my brother runs a small business. He employs about, I don't know, 20-odd people. Mm. And he said before the lockdown was announced, before all these measures were announced, he's in the tourism industry.
Oy.
It's very simple. I have no business whatsoever, no reason to come to the office except to lay off people.
Gee.
And that's an immediate and dramatic effect. So, you know, we'll have to see whether he can pick up his business 3 months from now or 6 months from now or when tourism recovers. I suspect that a lot of people will have lost their jobs and may not have a job to come back to.
Mm.
That plays itself out in thousands of other companies.
Look, the flip side of this is that coming out of this mess, the way in which we claw ourselves back into being a functioning economy is to get rid of the massive amount of red tape that actually prevents the economy from actually taking over. And fascinating stuff that's now been emerging from the U.S. directly as a result of people being forced to shut down by this entire pandemic is the amount of petty regulations that have suddenly been just overruled.
Hmm.
So, for example, one of the things that struck me was that in Boston, for example, if you were running a restaurant, you needed a specific separate license in order for people to be able to come to your restaurant and pick up food and take it away with them. Think about the absurdity of that for a second.
Stupid.
But again, this is what governments do. It is regulation for the sake of regulation. If you look in terms of things like all of our BEE legislation, as the single biggest impediment in our country right now to wealth creation,
mm-hmm.
There's an opportunity here to actually drive a truck through all of that and just say, we're actually going to let the free market kick in and let this economy actually fly, and let people do whatever the hell they need to do to actually survive.
But will
so at that level,
but will the government do that? Because we've seen even in even in you know, preparatory discussions around what would happen to the economy, we've seen a complete lack of understanding from certain quarters in the ANC, and we see their politics manifest in. You know, there was that original discussion document, which probably shouldn't have been leaked, about 51% black-owned businesses would be the only ones to benefit from the Solidarity Fund. And the statement, which I saw during the press conference, I saw it happening live and couldn't believe what I was hearing from the Department of Small Business, that spaza shops would be allowed to stay open, but not spaza shops owned by those who are not South African. And I thought, no, you see, this is where the ideological and the policy stuff leaks through and overwhelms what should be common sense in a time where common sense is the only thing that's worth keeping a hold on. Am I wrong?
Well, certainly in terms of the spaza shops, the spaza shops are a good example of why the government is not as powerful as they think they are.
Yeah.
Because as much as the government may express that particular view, because of the fact that government actually doesn't live in those areas and they're not aware of the day-to-day reality on the ground, they're not in a position to actually enforce a scenario where people in those areas are going to need facilities that the spaza shops provide, and the spaza shops are going to provide them. Irrespective of whatever the Minister of Small Business Development might think is going to happen. And this is the point that I'm talking about in terms of resetting the economy, because the government's stranglehold on the economy really is the government's stranglehold on the banking sector.
Mm-hmm.
Because fundamentally, that's where the government's power comes from. It's the ability to control that flow of money, and it's the ability to extract wealth from individuals by taking tax before your salary actually hits your pocket. That's of a formal economy that's actually functioning. What then tends to happen is that informal cash economies then tend to blossom. And I think that there's a very strong case to be made for the fact that the government will not be able to enforce whatever regulations they need to put in place simply in order for people to survive in those areas.
And you think that relationship between government and banks will be disrupted by what's going on at the moment?
No, I don't think so. I think that the banks are so utterly ingrained with the system. Look, ask yourself why, unlike the situation in Kenya, we have not been able to embrace mobile payments. So, again, is because it's necessary for government stranglehold of how money actually flows through the entire economy. So, an opportunity here for a mobile payment system to be kicking in that would piggyback on top of our telco networks, but actually allow people to move money around between themselves in a way that bypasses government. I think that there's an opportunity certainly going to kick in here. In fact, right now, were I running the telcos, I would have turned around and said, this is the time through mobile money, big time, because if you think of the overall impact in terms of reduction of the need to physically move cash around the country, look in terms of the reduction of the possibility of transmitting the virus by physically handling cash, the benefits are massive. So is there a chance now for enough of a outcry for people to say, this is one of the most basic things that we need to change, which again is going to remove some power from the hands of government? I think so, but we're going to need to see how it plays itself out over the next 3 weeks. Starving people are really difficult to be locked down by this particular government.
What do you think, Ivor?
I'm not that optimistic. I see where kind of the sort of see silver linings, but it's a bit like saying, well, you know, if we destroy all of Europe in a hypothetical war, you know, let's say we have a funny German who decides to kill a bunch of people he doesn't like, and we have a war and we flatten Europe, purely hypothetically speaking, we could then rebuild. And we would have nice modern buildings and, you know, everything would run far more efficiently and we'd have high-speed trains and so on. And that would be a good thing. What you don't count is the cost of the destruction in the first place, the cost that you paid for that progress. So yes, it's like your house burning down and saying, well, now you can build a new house which doesn't have all the cracks and the leaks that the old house had. Yes, you can, but your house still burnt down. You know, which is so the cost of destruction might not be worth the nice things we might have as a result of rebuilding. I do agree with him about the black market.
We're in agreement on that, by the way, Avoki. We're in agreement. Okay. I'm just saying that the house has already burnt down, and so the silver lining comes afterwards. I would not
burn down. Fair enough. I have a much bigger fear, though. If you read Crisis and Leviathan, which is written by Robert Higgs, he writes about how periods of crisis, like depression and war, are used to expand the scope of government.
Right.
Right. And once governments expanded their size and their scope and their powers,
you never get that back.
They retrench some, but not to the same level as before. So these are sort of ratchet points in expanding the size and power of government. In 1984, you'll see that the government uses an entirely fictional permanent crisis, the war, the fictional war that they have there, in order to sustain and expand. Oh, there we go.
I'm holding the book up.
In order to sustain and expand their
power. It was right here. I was talking to Mbulelo about this book the other day. Mbulelo, you actually keep a copy of it with you wherever you go as well.
Yes.
Was that absolutely?
Yeah.
1984.
Yes.
I certainly do. Ivo, I just want to jump in there and maybe ask you something. So I want to state my position is I'm centralist, leaning very heavily left. And I don't know how many more examples we're going to need to see that this iteration. So I'm not of the left of we need to go back to Marxist times. That's crazy. That's nuts, right? But how many more times do we need to see the limitations of the current iteration of capitalism before we say to ourselves this Fukuyama kind of view of let's do what we're doing now but tweak a few things doesn't work because we're seeing the sharp limitations of capitalism in this iteration, right? How many more times do we need to keep saying, oh, just change this, change that, rather than at some stage stop kicking the can down the road? We have to have a second iteration because this is nuts that we're still doing economy like we do it now. So I'm a fan of maybe the cost of burn now might be worth it in a time of accelerated change. You know, we panic and say, if capitalism was to stop being as it is now, the rate of change would be the same as it was in the 20s, which we know it won't. So we need to see how limited we are right now.
What do you say to that, Ivor, before we get back to your point about 84?
There's your threat right there. I mean, I've seen a number of articles saying, the whole problem is the neoliberal model of capitalism, and we should exploit this to force a sweeping transformation of the country's economy towards state-controlled socialism and the destruction of the private sector. I see that as a massive threat. Look, the argument is really that freedom and free markets, individual freedom and free markets, they do have their costs, right? I often use the analogy that if you want to be personally safe from crime and murder and so on, one of the best places to be is in a fascist police state. Right?
Yeah.
Because if you have the police everywhere and everyone is under surveillance, right, crime is very low and your personal safety is very high. Right? Now, the question is, is that a sufficient price to pay for that personal safety? Mm. And a lot of people in history and now actually conclude, no, it's not. Even though freedom has its limitations and freedom does cause, it causes people to behave, or some people will behave in a free society in ways that we don't like.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that we ought to sacrifice the freedoms in the first place. And if you look at what government's doing now, they just decided the mobile phone companies have just decided to share their location data with the government. So the government will now be tracking the location of all of us.
Yeah.
Oh, because it's a crisis. But, you know, once they've got this power, once they know how to use it, who says they're going to stop using it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if they do stop using it, if they do roll back these powers, and, you know, I find it alarming how quickly the government managed to shut down most of our economy and effectively take over the rest. You know, even without a state of emergency, and with the constitution still in effect. You know, we've been confined to our houses under house arrest with no jobs. I mean, this is really alarming. If they roll back all those powers, well, what happens with the next virus, the next pandemic, right?
Yeah.
Which in South Africa has killed no one. It's infected about 400 or so. The next pandemic is going to look like it might be a problem, right? And they're going to lock down again. Are we going to live in this permanent sort of healthcare totalitarian state?
Yeah.
Are we going to let our fear of pandemics, difficult for free countries to deal with, are we going to use that as a reason to sacrifice our essential liberties?
Well, this is the big question.
I just want to chime in on what Mbulele was saying here, Gareth.
Okay.
Because there's a popular narrative right now that says, look, this is all the fault of global capitalism. Because of you guys, you know, with racking up your frequent flyer miles, going around the world, distributing this virus, and it's time to now shut down you guys and do a complete reset, and let's try and build a better world. Let's be very clear about one thing. Where did this virus actually emanate from? It emanated from the... And the reason why we know about the virus is because of free thought, because of the media, because we actually pointed out that this was going on and that the Chinese were keeping quiet about it. And by shining the cold light of day that comes with freedom, what the state was up to, it actually then forced the Chinese to very quickly walk back everything that they were saying. No, the virus doesn't actually hop from one person to another. And more to the point, the Chinese had actually bludgeoned the World Health Organization into agreeing with the same thing. The WHO, after discussions with the Chinese, issued a statement in January saying that, no, the rate of transmission from one person to another is extremely low. when we put our faith in centralized power and remove the ability of individuals to actually have agency and to say, hang on a second, guys, we need to take a contrarian view on this, and we need to actually questions around if we do something entirely different or what happens if a proposition is not true. But increasingly, we've been moving to an environment where particular subjects become taboo. So we saw exactly this process playing itself out terms of the entire discussions around the relationship between carbon dioxide and global warming.
Mm-hmm.
Any attempt by any person to raise any discussion to the contrary is immediately shut down. I find it extremely disturbing right now that that Branko at Daily Maverick was not willing to publish Ivo's column. That for me is chilling, because I actually expect that we need to have reasoned opinions as possible being tossed into the fray so that people are able to examine them and make decisions. And all of those are as a direct result of having a fundamentally individual freedom framework in society, which is what capitalism is all about.
Yeah. So let me make my position clear, is that, you know, the defense always when you bring something like this up is that the opposite of capitalism is communism, which I will not argue for. Is the opposite of capitalism, the very poor version of capitalism we have now, because let's face it, capitalism is the best, most dynamic system we have ever found to distribute wealth.
So what's your problem?
Is that we need to get better at sharing. So the opposite of pure capitalism.
How do we?
Is now,
okay, but Mulelo, how do we do that? Yeah. Do we allow government? Do we allow more state control? Must they be the masters of how to appropriate and expropriate people? Because then
I think, look,
specific example, Gareth. Right now, we've got Rupert, and we've got the Oppenheimers. R1 billion.
Yeah, each.
But look,
that's sharing. That's capitalism sharing.
You know,
I don't see Patrice Motsepe coming to the party and saying, "Here, have
or
a couple
or Cyril, for that matter. He's a billionaire."
Exactly. Yeah. Yes.
Look, the temptation is to always say immediately and say, yes, how do we do it now? Look, before we get to that, let's review what we're doing now and whether it works or not. And
it has worked.
But
and
yes,
there is ample evidence over the last 60 years to show that capitalism not only works, but that it is the single best way to bring people out of poverty. It is the single best way to empower the individual. And it has helped countless people. So,
I've said that.
So what's your beef?
So what I'm saying is, let's stop getting obsessed with this version of capitalism being the be-all and end-all. It must keep evolving. Nobody ever says that. You know, after 2008, it was almost like, oh, well, we're done. Let's just carry on again and we'll rebuild and we'll be fine. And nobody says...
So you're you're saying this isn't perfect, so we need something better.
But we need to stay in that conversation.
But who's against that position? It doesn't help us move forward, though. I mean, utopianism is not going to get us anywhere either. And the idea that there is a more perfect system sounds to me a lot more like Marx or Lenin.
No, there's a contradiction here. You know, if you say, you know, normally my argument would be just look at the World Economic Freedom Index and the correlation between that and just about any of human welfare that you can imagine. You know, whether it's prosperity or poverty levels or child mortality, you know, life expectancy, etc. You name the measure, it's positively correlated with economic freedom.
Yes.
And, you know, sure. You look at socialist countries. Well, if you want to go socialist, well, you know, have a look at Venezuela. You know,
sure.
That might be an extreme example, but socialist countries significantly underperform capitalist countries in all of these measures.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, the downsides of a capitalist economy, you know, no system is perfect, right? And the downsides of a capitalist economy, they are a price worth paying for all of those better quality of life indicators.
But why do people always say Venezuela? But, why do they say Sweden?
No, but then...
Because Sweden is a capitalist country.
It's a social capitalist country.
No,
so it's always been there.
Bulero.
There's nothing socialist about Sweden except for their alcohol industry.
Sure.
The state is the only one allowed to sell alcohol in Sweden, which is as communist as it can get. But their economy, right, is very, very free. You look at all the, you know, if you look at the ranking on the, all of those Scandinavian countries are in the top quarter, the most free countries in the world.
In fact,
the most free economies in the world.
In fact, that is the only reason they can afford to have the social programs that they have, which makes them a social democracy. So it's a chicken or egg situation where we actually do know.
They got rich first.
Correct. We do know which came first, and it wasn't the egg. The egg of socialism.
They got rich first,
yeah,
and then they instituted a welfare state.
It's
all good.
They
bought a welfare state.
It's like
their capitalist wealth.
It's like everything was going very well for Venezuela when they were participating in the world economy and oil prices were high and they could sell their stuff, which is capitalism, into a market that wanted their stuff, you know, supply and demand. But as soon as they ran out of that one lever that they had, socialism reared its ugly head for the monster that it is, and people went into abject poverty and started eating their pets. It's not a pleasant system, and there's just no... You cannot draw what do they call it, a false equivalency between what's going on in Venezuela and the idea that that can be a more perfect system. It's just not possible. Something has won and something has lost. I can't believe we're still having this discussion.
No, but one of the things I want to say to him, Bruno, is that, you know, there's this presumption that there are different types of capitalism. And, you see, the reason why I fundamentally disagree with that is because you either have individual freedom or you don't. And capitalism is the natural consequence of having individual freedom. And if you actually recognize that that is the fundamental truth that governs the way in which this works, there is only one type of capitalism. So in as much as you might say we need to reform capitalism, it's not going to work. Capitalism is going to take different shapes and forms very much on what local conditions happen to be and what the markets are prepared to tolerate in particular places. So, you know, we might well have a scenario, for example, where there is a free market trade in eating pangolins, as has been the case in many parts of China. That would never happen in most parts of the UK, because there would be a fundamental revulsion on the part of the market to actually accept that as a business model. How do you actually reconcile those? Capitalism is capitalism. Really, what we need to be addressing is crony corporatism, which is what we have seen happening in this country, where we've had protectionism of particular that has taken place, specifically because of collusion between corporates and government. And that is completely contrary to the entire basis on which capitalism actually thrives and succeeds. You want to look at capitalism, look at those spaza shops. That is capitalism unleashed.
So
that has to respond to the markets.
So to go back to the point Ivo was going to make about how a state, once it takes away some people's civil liberties, and the US had this discussion under, you know, George W. Bush, where he implemented several measures to break privacy laws and to gather people's personal information in the name of fighting terrorism. And those laws have never been revoked. And people are still living in a semi-surveillance state in America, because government very seldom give that power back, right, Ivo? And that was what brought up 1984, which is why Bulelo and you and I and Canton started talking about communism and capitalism. But effectively, the concern is that a government like the one we have here in South Africa, which has increasingly seen its influence on the wane, less and less people go to the polls, people just blatantly disregard government edicts and regulations like e-tolls. People are not particularly impressed with this government because they've run parastatals into the ground. The economy is not being managed well. So up to a few days ago, government were not really in business. And now they're back in business. And they're able to craft all kinds of laws, enact all kinds of lockdowns, make it seem like they're doing things. And they are largely trying to do things. I mean, I don't believe our government has the malicious intention of seeing people die. But your concern is, will they give the power back to the people at the end of this?
And history shows that they don't. You know, that's the problem. Our government hasn't even given some apartheid powers back to the people.
Correct.
You know, we're still under apartheid security laws. They use those laws against citizens. Now they aggregate. You know, suddenly in a crisis, people run to government and say, "Save us!" You know. How are you going to expect government to save us if they can't keep the lights on? You know, I don't know why people think the government can save us or should save us in these sort of situations. Yeah, the threat of creeping totalitarianism, I think, is huge. And not only in South Africa right now, it's the world over.
Well, you see it happening in Russia, where they claim to have a very, very low infection rate and an even lower death rate. And people are attributing that to the fact that Russia is essentially a totalitarian state where everyone's constantly being monitored. They were the guys who came up with this first and foremost, and Putin has made some very severe rules.
Putin says about their infection rate. I'm sure he never lies.
Yeah.
I think this goes directly back to Ivo's earlier point about, you know, when you live in a fascist state, yes, you do have safety and security, but...
So, all right.
Would I be prepared to?
We've got a minute or two left, and I'd like to ask all three of you, Ivo Mbulelo and Canton, what do you think the economy will be like if we get back to work in a month or two? Will we be able to resuscitate parts of it? And what do you think it will be like if this continues for 3 months?
The longer this carries on, the worse the damage will get, and I think it will take us years to recover. You know, if you look on growth charts or something, we will see the lost growth of this year for many, many years to come. And that is going to set back the poverty alleviation project. It's going to set back the project to bring clean sanitation and drinking water to people. It's going to set back our public health project. You know, all of that is going to suffer. I really am pretty pessimistic about how the damage that this is doing to the South African economy. Unemployment is going to be high, and it'll take a long time to get that even back down to 30%, which is where we are now. So yeah, I'm really pessimistic about the effects of this of these measures, this lockdown, on the South African economy. And the longer it lasts, the worse it'll get.
Canton?
I'm afraid I actually completely agree with Ivo. You know, I don't think that people are actually aware at this point of the extent of the devastation that's already kicked in terms of our economy, because we haven't had figures that have actually unleashed since over the past 2 weeks. I think it's going to take us years. It's going to take us decades, possibly, but also take this view that what you are going to see directly as a result of this is, and say, now it's time to go after those prescribed assets. They've already gone into the unemployment insurance fund as a starting point. So been very carefully putting aside funds for our retirement age. You know, forget it. I'm very clear right now that whatever hopes that I might have had in terms of any of the value that I have in my retirement holdings on the JSE to be able to feed me into old age. So I'm going to have to make another plan now going forward.
You'll have to keep working forever.
So the looting right now is going to get significantly worse before we're in a position to have a total reset. And I'm afraid we have no way really of preventing that from happening.
Bulelo, you want to throw something in there?
Yeah, I think in what may sound brutal is that the strong will survive, I'm afraid, and the weak will be killed off. So if your business hasn't been well run for the last 5 years, I'm afraid.
Even if it has been run well, I mean, places like restaurants are not exactly poorly run. They just depend on day-to-day business.
I think this will expose the innovators, Gareth. The innovators will come through.
I have to challenge that. I'm sorry. I have to challenge that. If your business is well run, you're making a profit, you're employing people, you're doing perfectly fine, the government comes down, puts a gun in your face and says, shut the place down for 2 months. Right? It is not your fault that your business fails as a result. I'm sorry. That is, you can't lay that at the hand of badly run business.
The market forces are out of our hands, unfortunately.
It's not a market force.
It's tragic.
It's not a market force. This is government.
Yeah.
This is government edict putting the army on the street and shutting down your business. That's not market forces. I'm sorry.
I like this. I like that we've had a bit of a fight this morning. This is good. So thank you for throwing in your wild and dangerous opinions, Bulelo. And also, Canton, thank you as always. Ivo, I'm very happy to hear about your new project, and we'll all be reading the Daily Friend for all of your articles. So thank you very much for joining us this morning. Best of luck going forward, everybody. And good luck for the lockdown from midnight tonight.
Thank you.
All right. That is The Burning Platform, which is brought to you by Nando's.
Cliffcentral.com. CliffCentral.com.